Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, anti-apartheid movements in Florida.
It's in this late 1970s where you see these mass movements in South Africa, probably most famous of these in 1976, the Soweto Uprising, which makes people more aware.
We'll discuss teachers in post-Civil War Florida.
Black historians, such as W.E.B. Du Bois, hail the teachers as, quote, saintly souls who were New England's gift to the freedmen.
And we'll talk about efforts to fight the Ku Klux Klan in 1920s Palatka. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. In 1985, Stephen Van Sant from Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band assembled the group Artists Against Apartheid to record the protest song Sun City. As Sebastian Garcia reports, there were successful anti-apartheid movements in Florida.
Dr. Jacob Ivey is an associate professor of history at Florida Memorial University in Miami Gardens, Florida. I spoke with Dr. Ivey about the history of the anti-apartheid movement in Florida. Dr. Ivey has researched the subject extensively and is developing a book to fuse the research and the journal articles he has written over several years. The book's working title is From Sun City to Sunshine State, Florida and the Anti-Apartheid Movement. Dr. Ivey explained how the mass movement to condemn the apartheid regime in South Africa was catalyzed by the Soweto Uprising of 1976. This harrowing event galvanized certain individuals across the United States, including places like Florida, to take action against the apartheid regime.
It's in this late 1970s where you see these mass movements in South Africa, probably most famous of these in 1976, the Soweto Uprising, which makes people more aware of what's going on in South Africa. The police brutality, individuals being shot in the streets, children being shot in the streets. And because of this, people start saying, what can I do? How can I impact what's going on in South Africa? And particularly in places like Florida, it turns to this thing called divestment. The idea behind divestment is companies are doing business in South Africa. And these aren't just random South African businesses. These are places like IBM, Coca-Cola, all right, just big companies, Ford and the like. And they have factories. They have company headquarters and the like, or regional company headquarters and the like in these areas. And the idea is that if we take our money away from these companies, for example, if we divest and say buying stock for things like our pensions or our retirement programs, then we can hurt these companies and make them say, hey, maybe doing business in South Africa isn't profitable. You start seeing the formation and solidification of groups that are saying, what if we divest our local government? What if we divest our local universities?
The first question, what if we divest our local governments, guided individuals in Orlando, Florida, to support the anti-apartheid movement. However, Orlando's mayor at the time, Bill Frederick, seemed less enthusiastic to endorse the movement, primarily because Mayor Frederick and others viewed the impact of full divestment as a mechanism against the apartheid regime as insignificant, and even possibly harmful to the city of Orlando. In addition, they adhered to and were proponents of the Sullivan Principles.
Individuals like Bill Frederick and others were supporters of this thing called the Sullivan Principles. Now, the Sullivan Principles were created in the late 1970s. And what Sullivan said was, what if we give these rules, these guidelines for companies doing business in South Africa, saying you can't be discriminatory, you have to have fair wages, you have to have fair hours, and you can't treat white and black employees differently. A lot of companies that signed on to this, they thought that was good enough. But for many individuals, particularly in Orlando, who were supporting the full divestment movement, They didn't think that was enough because these companies were still doing business in South Africa, still making money in South Africa, and by proxy, supporting the apartheid regime more broadly.
This division between full divestment and adherence to the Sullivan Principles created tension between the local government and the Free South Africa Coalition, FSAC, a diverse group of community members responsible for the anti-apartheid movement in Orlando. To demonstrate their commitment and the severity of the situation, the FSAC organized a march on October 11, 1985. Despite the bureaucratic hurdles that the city of Orlando threw at the FSAC to stymie this organized event, the march ultimately happened.
Initially, they're expecting around 200 protesters. But when all is said and done, about 400 people gather outside Mount Zion Baptist Church. And the idea is they're going to march from the Mount Zion Baptist Church to City Hall. And they're going to have signs, they're going to have chants, and the plan is to end this march at the footsteps of City Hall. They'll have speakers who will, you know, condemn the apartheid system more broadly, and in many ways having a rally for the support of the anti-apartheid movement and the end of this regime overall. What the march provides is a visual moment for the residents of Orlando to see this matters. People are going into the streets and gathering for change.
The march also provided the necessary impetus for the city of Orlando to discuss this issue of divestment with a series of committees and public hearings from November 1985 to May 1986. As Dr. Ivy stated, a theme of morality versus financial practicality would define these committees and public hearings, most notably the December 2nd, 1985 hearing.
This divide over morality versus practicality really becomes the central focus of this December 2nd meeting. And in truth, the December 2nd meeting had made progress. You had the mayor, Mayor Frederick, who said, we're going to partially divest and put this forward before the city council. But at the same time, right off the bat, you know, this proposal for partial divestment is rejected from 4-3, and you just hear this exacerbated tone from the audience more broadly. And you have individuals who are speakers, a gentleman who is a South African exile, an individual who was in South Africa, was no longer able to live in South Africa because of the system of apartheid, because he had been banned from returning to South Africa. And he essentially argues that this is about the degradation of society. This is about the degradation of the way Black people are able to live within South Africa. And if you hide behind these Sullivan principles, in the end, you're hiding behind something that is ostensibly endorsing cruelty, endorsing murder. And in those instances, I think you see at least elements of the message beginning to come through.
The message of full divestment, grounded in moral arguments, ultimately was tested at the final public hearing on May 5, 1986, where the city of Orlando was scheduled to give its final verdict. Before the verdict was issued, another South African, this time of a more prominent background, gave one last word to convince the city of Orlando to fully divest.
Yotandi Luthuli, and that's Albert Luthuli's daughter. And Albert Luthuli, who don't know, he was a Nobel laureate. You know, he was one of the first South Africans to win the Nobel Peace Prize. The other was Nelson Mandela on this front. And he was one of the first major leaders of the anti-apartheid movement and the African National Congress. But you have the daughter of one of the most famous leaders of, or Black leaders of South Africa, who is ostensibly talking to this Orlando City Council and talking to this Orlando City Council, ostensibly condemning them for not supporting full divestment. And in fact, she specifically says, quote, if you vote for divestment, you are using the only tool that is in your control to end violence, torture, and repression against Blacks. Now, the problem, of course, is that when all is said and done, even though we have these impassioned pleas by the members of the community, the final verdict for the Orlando City Council is incomplete. They do pass a resolution on divestment, but they really don't do anything more than make sure that they are doing business with companies that are adhering to the Sullivan principles. The city council voted for what is pretty much a watered down divestment program. And obviously, this has a sense of being incomplete, though it is admittedly a partial success.
As Orlando struggled to achieve this partial success, the anti-apartheid movement raged in other parts of Florida, particularly in Gainesville at the University of Florida.
Very similar to what we see in Orlando, a group of individuals, in this case, a group of students who are eventually going to form an organization called the Student Coalition Against Apartheid and Racism, or SCAR, with two A's. And just like what we saw in Orlando, they are calling for the University of Florida to divest themselves with companies that are doing business in South Africa. And just like we saw in the city of Orlando, you have the president of the university push back against it. You have administration pushing back against it. And instead of doing a peaceful march through the streets of Gainesville, these student protesters decide they're going to go to the main administrative building, Tigard Hall. And it's smack dab in the middle of campus. And what do? They go to it and they try to take it over. And take it over in a hostile way, but they put bike chains around the doors. They try to keep people from going in and out. It's also the place where students register for classes, so they can't sign up for classes and the like. And they basically create, very much in line with the civil disobedience that we saw during the civil rights movement, make the campus, or at least this part of the campus, unlivable and inhospitable as a means of making people aware of what's going on and to increase pressure on the university president and the university administration more broadly to facilitate a kind of change.
One critical difference between the anti-apartheid movement in Orlando and at the University of Florida was the degree to which UF students experienced pushback during their 40-day sit-in outside Tigard Hall.
There is pushback. Part of that, again, goes to the fact that while Gainesville is this liberal island in the middle of North Florida, the rest of the area is incredibly conservative, and even more so in the 1980s. There were individuals who were counter-protesters, active counter-protesters that took part in these instances. One of the more harrowing instances was related to a young student who was, in fact, raped. Now, from what I found, there's no direct evidence that this woman was sexually assaulted because of her support of the protest. It's likely that it was a wrong place, wrong time kind of situation, and this horrendous event occurred to her. But it cast this shadow over the entirety of the protest, and in fact, probably one of the reasons why it does eventually come to an end. You do, however, have individuals who come in and attack. There's one particular incident where a UF student actually drives his Ford Mustang into the protest camp and basically starts ripping off signs. And luckily, no one was hurt, but this is the type of repercussions and the type of pushback that the students receive on this front. But they remain because, again, they believe that this is critical to create awareness and pressure on the university administration.
The University of Florida ultimately succumbed to the pressure and decided to hold a meeting amongst themselves to discuss the issue of divestment. However, similar to the verdict the city of Orlando made, the University of Florida, in adherence to the Sullivan principles, agreed to a partial divestment. As Dr. Ivy vividly demonstrated, Florida was a crucial and contested battleground for the call to end the apartheid regime in South Africa. When I asked Dr. Ivy why there was such variation in how individuals responded in North, Central, and South Florida, Dr. Ivy answered,
I think one of the biggest issues is the fact that, as we know today, Florida is not a monolith. There are multitudes of areas of Florida that have a variety of political, ethnic, and socioeconomic standings that are going to significantly impact how they're going to respond to something like this, a movement like this in these instances. One of the other big issues associated with Florida as well, in conjunction with the Cold War, is the issue of ethnicity and backgrounds. And the city of Miami, as you know, and everyone listening knows, has an incredibly large Hispanic and particularly Cuban population. And that Cuban population is a byproduct of the Cold War and a byproduct of, frankly, a anti-communist bent to people's perspectives of international and foreign policy. So what we see in Florida is, again, just like it is today, it is not a single group, a single entity. So it depended on a multitude of factors on how they would respond to this anti-apartheid movement more broadly.
To listen to my entire conversation with Dr. Jacob Ivey regarding the history of the anti-apartheid movement in Florida and his other works, please check out the UCF Department of History's podcast, Knight's History Cast, available wherever you listen to music and podcasts. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS Media Production Assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org.
When Johnny comes marching home again, hurrah, hurrah, we'll give him a hearty welcome then, hurrah, hurrah, for the men will cheer the boys.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, the end of the Civil War left the South in chaos. The loss of life, homes, and farms, the destruction of infrastructure, the lingering discord between friends and family who supported opposing sides in the conflict left the region, as W.J. Cash said, in a frontier state. White Southerners did not generally appreciate the efforts by Northerners to rebuild the region.
No, they didn't. Assistance that came through the federally supported Bureau of Refugees, Freedmen, and Abandoned Lands, commonly known as the Freedmen's Bureau, and organizations such as the American Missionary Association, AMA, were especially vilified for their efforts to teach black children and adults in order to prepare them for success in the post-slavery South. As Laura Wallace Wakefield notes in her 2003 Florida Historical Quarterly article on the AMA teachers who began arriving in Florida as early as 1863, quote, most had been abolitionists. Their idealism set them apart even from the mainstream of Northern society, and combined with their collective identity as Yankees, immediately put them at odds with Florida's white population. Consequently, violent resistance rose against these Northern teachers and their efforts to transform freedmen and women into full citizens, end quote. The teachers, mostly women, left a record of their challenges in letters they wrote to the American Missionary Association and the Freedmen's Bureau. Using these letters, successive generations of historians constructed conflicting interpretations of their work and its efforts on Southern and Florida history. In 1913, William Watson Davis denounced, quote, the proselytizing, patronizing newcomer from the North and characterized them as generally social outcasts. W.J. Cash, writing in 1941, called the teachers dangerous fools, and even as late as 1967, Henry Lee Swint blamed the zealous teachers whose attempts to control the black vote incited the violent reaction of white Southerners. Writing in the same period, black historians such as W.E.B. Du Bois hailed the teachers as, quote, saintly souls who were New England's gift to the freedmen, end quote. By the mid-20th century, interpretations increasingly viewed the activities of the Northern teachers in more positive terms. James McPherson praised the continuity between teachers' fervor for the work and the antebellum abolitionist movement. In his 1965 book on Reconstruction in Florida, Joe M. Richardson, quote, credited the educational work of the teachers, supported by governmental and sectarian organizations, with laying the groundwork for public education in the South, end quote. Wakefield herself, a public school teacher, focuses her research for this article on the experiences of the women who traveled to Florida to teach in the period 1866 to 1870.
Connie, these women came to Florida alone or sometimes in pairs. They entered a state with a population of only 200,000, a frontier in every sense of the word. Public education was not a priority before the Civil War, and it seems unlikely Floridians would be focused on public education after the war in 1866.
As Wakefield explains, quote, "widespread apathy, the frontier conditions, and a lack of funding undermined efforts to create a system of public education," end quote. Indeed, it was widely reported that in 1866 there were, quote, "far fewer white schools than freedmen schools in Florida." If whites were apathetic, newly emancipated men and women viewed education as the mechanism for engaging in the larger social, political, and economic world to which they now had access. They eagerly sought education for themselves and their children. For them, learning to read was akin to eating the long-forbidden fruit. Reports by the Freedmen's Bureau agents and the American Missionary Association point to the enthusiasm for learning among the black students of all ages and praise the progress made within months of emancipation. Harriet Greeley observed that her students in St. Augustine were motivated by their desire to read the Bible. She fueled that motivation by promising, quote, "to provide individual copies of the New Testament once her students could read it," end quote. If student enthusiasm sustained their work, the teachers were initially motivated to travel south by, quote, "fervent religious convictions, strong anti-slavery beliefs, and generous humanitarian impulses," end quote. As Wakefield notes, quote, "strong abolitionist backgrounds were common, and teachers saw themselves as instruments in the transforming of Southern society," end quote. White Southerners were not wrong in recognizing that the motivations of the teachers translated into the training of black students to identify with the Republican Party. They also correctly recognized the teachers' views of poor whites as ignorant and possessing slovenly work habits. As a result, the teachers faced discrimination from the white community of Southerners and, in many cases, newly transplanted Yankees who, like their Southern counterparts, condemned the teachers for their close association with black students and families.
Teachers faced daunting challenges in their daily lives in addition to instructing large numbers of students and providing rudimentary social services to black families.
From the moment they entered the state, these Yankee teachers were largely on their own to find housing and locate spaces for classrooms. They were ostracized by Southern whites. They faced the usual problems of heat and humidity, insects and diseases such as malaria that were ubiquitous to the South. Wakefield describes the arrival in Jacksonville of Maggie Gardner, who wrote, quote, "I reached Baldwin about noon and must wait there till midnight, reaching Jacksonville at 2 o'clock, alone at night, in a strange place with no one to meet me. I believe in those 2 days I passed the longest and loneliest hours my life ever knew," end quote. As previously noted, these women had few opportunities for socialization, as they were ignored by the white community. Wakefield notes that, quote, "it was often difficult to find a suitable place to live, and when found, the housing was seldom comfortable and often expensive. There were complaints about hard and soiled beds and walls with cracks to the outside. Two teachers arrived in Gainesville to find that their cottage had no furnishings. They borrowed a mattress from a nearby black family and slept on the floor. Even meals were plain, with one teacher describing them as pretty much the same each day, so our appetites are not pampered at all." By the late 1860s, however, Wakefield claims, quote, "outright hostility against freedmen education had shifted to indifference, and among some white Floridians, even cooperation." Freedmen's Bureau Assistant Superintendent E.B. Duncan wrote, quote, "the intelligent and better class of our citizens are the decided friends of the freedmen, alive to their present condition, and are decidedly in favor of their elevation and improvement," end quote. Education for black students expanded throughout the 1860s and into the 1870s. By 1874, there were 3 black high schools, Stanton Normal Institute in Jacksonville, Lincoln's Academy in Tallahassee, and Douglas High School in Key West. In 1870, 16% of Florida blacks aged 10 years and older were literate, an extraordinary achievement in the face of the challenges they faced. I'll read Wakefield's conclusion in its entirety. "In Florida, a new order rose with Reconstruction. a system of public education developed with the guidance of Northerners, the assistance of the Freedmen's Bureau, and in response to the fervent desires of Florida's black citizens. And its success contributed to the growth of a state-sponsored public school system. Even as the Yankee teachers departed Florida, they remained influential, having trained future black teachers and elevated black literacy rates. As W.E.B. Du Bois phrased it, their work was, quote, the finest thing in American history.
And modern teachers continue to face challenges, of course, but much different challenges than the post-Civil War educators in Florida. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. In the early 20th century, the Ku Klux Klan was very active throughout Florida. After World War I, the Florida Klan reorganized near Palatka. The increasingly aggressive Klan encountered strong opposition. Peter Hagen served as Putnam County Sheriff from 1916 to 1924 and again from 1928 to 1930. In a time when many politicians and members of law enforcement were also members of the Klan in Florida, Peter Hagen openly opposed them and stopped lynchings. Billy Townsend is author of the book Age of Barbarity, The Forgotten Fight for the Soul of Florida. Townsend says that when Peter Hagen lost re-election as sheriff in 1924, the KKK operated with impunity.
And they would go on these beating sprees. They would abduct people, black and white, men and women, would beat them for sort of for drinking mostly, but for cultural things. And after two black men were killed trying to rescue one of their mother in 1926, and that attack caused the governor of Florida to threaten to declare martial law in Putnam County. My great grandfather was involved, very much involved in the resistance to that. His name was Judge Walton. Judge was his first name. He was a lawyer, but not a judge. And then in 1928, the sheriff who had done the lynching repulsion in 1928, he came back and ran again and won in a very narrow win. And it was, to my knowledge, the only true Democratic repudiation of the Klan, maybe in the South, like certainly in Florida. It defeated the Florida Klan, the most important and most powerful Florida Klan, which was the Klan of the 20s.
Billy Townsend is author of the book Age of Barbarity, The Forgotten Fight for the Soul of Florida. Watch more of our conversation in Florida Frontiers Television Episode 58, Memories of Palatka, accessible online at myfloridahistory.org. You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week, and until then, find us on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Sebastian Garcia and Connie Lester. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.